Greetings, caravanners around the world. This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. I am John B. in the left seat of Ark Midnight, here hovering on the cyber wave. Feels kind of good. Moderation in all things, right? Look, things are really, really heating up. I'm not kidding you either. All over the place. And to that end, we will discuss exactly what's heating up and why it's serious. And which is what we do, of course. Sort of a unnecessary statement of mission. So we'll be joined by Harry S. Dent, founder of Dent Research.
This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Here is John B.
And now we look forward to our conversation with Mr. Marshall Masters, former CNN Science Features news producer, freelance writer, television analyst, and the publisher of Yowza.com. Y-O-W-U-S-A, Yowza. I get it. Since 1999, he's been researching Earth changes and Nibiru flyby-related topics, including sustainable survival communities, catastrophic crop circles, impact events, and future technologies. Like many others, Mr. Marshall sees a dark cloud coming. What makes him different is that he also sees a silver lining, a noble and inspiring Star Trekian future. His books, Crossing the Cusp, Planet X Forecast, and the 2012 Survival Guide, and the new one, Being in It for the Species, The Universe Speaks. Wow, and when the universe speaks, I'd say we would do well to listen. Welcome, Mr. Masters. Thanks for making the time for us. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, so, and now NASA has, do your studies correlate to NASA's recent, maybe they've had it for a long time, but we've just heard about in the last couple of days, they're like official Armageddon office as far as space-related objects flying by, threatening the Earth and all of that?
Actually, that would be consistent with the trend that we're seeing. And there's two things that we're monitoring right now that are harbinger signs of the approaching Planet X system: earthquakes and fireballs. And if you look at what we see with earthquakes, we've been tracking them, and there's a lot of disinformation out there in terms of how they set the point for the magnitude of the quakes. We look from 4.0 and above, and others that'll say, well, it's really going down, are looking at 5.0 and above. But, you know, it's just where you peg the statistics. You can see that we're just experiencing a substantial and massive increase in the number of quakes since 1970. All right. And interestingly enough, you know, with this chart, 1970, I was in high school, and I could remember all the conversation about us being in a binary star system with another sun called Nemesis. And then that conversation just seemed to die away inexplicably. Years later, I came back to it as a researcher. But if you look at, in terms of earthquakes worldwide from 1970 to 2014, substantial increase. Now, you know, then they're going to say, well, that's because we have more reporting stations and all of that. That might make a difference of 10%, but it's not going to explain such a huge increase. However, the one that really troubles us the most are going to be the monthly total fireballs. This is something we are tracking consistently. And here's a graph that we published in our recent Signs article on our site at YOWUSA.com. And this one is showing for 2013, 2014, 2015. And what you're seeing is an overall consistent trend. However, in November of 2015, the reporting data from AMS, American Meteor Society, just simply jumped off the chart. And far, far, far above what we actually statistically trended for November. So if we're seeing this, all right, in November, and now NASA is throwing a lot of money into this meteor watch, well, it makes sense.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earthquakes also. And
That's right.
I mean, this is really kind of complex. Let's see if we can merge all of this stuff. This Planet X has been has been buzzing us over millennia, I take it. And a couple of researchers, Gil Broussard comes to mind, Jonathan Cahn comes to mind. There are biblical references, as I understand it, to this. And it doesn't go into a great deal of detail, but it's definitely there. And I just wonder, just kind of take it from there, Marshall, and just take us where you want to go with that. Because this, you know, for a long time before I got into this, I mean, even to the depth that I have, I thought, yeah, whatever. And now it's like, no, it's not whatever. This is a real thing. And it is, isn't it?
It is. It's very real. And if you're going to use, in a flyby scenario, Planet X system is a brown dwarf with its own mini constellation cluster of planets and moons. And it's in a very steep inclined to the ecliptic, the plane of our solar system, coming up, swooping around the sun, and then going way back south again. And it does that in a 3,600-year orbit. But it's also twisting around. It's kind of a corkscrew. So it's going up and down, but it's also going around at the same time. And think of it like a carousel in the amusement park. You're on the horse, and the horse is going up and down, and the carousel is going around. So you're moving on two axes. Same thing with the Planet X system. It's moving around the sun about every 380 days. But it takes 3,600 years for it to go from one end of its orbit to the other. And that's the reason why it's behind the sun right now, starting to pop out, and we're merging with it because we're just a little faster than it is. And that's the reason why these objects are coming out from behind the sun. And there's two flyby scenarios, and both are rooted in the biblical stories of Noah and the flood and the 10 plagues of Exodus. Now, there's also a corollary to this. There's a ancient wisdom text, secular text, called the Colburn Bible. And it was penned by the ancient Egyptians and then later by the Celts in the second half of it. Now, what it does is it goes into much more detail on these two allegorical accounts in the Bible, really fleshes it out. And what the Colburn Bible says is both of these events were the result of flybys. Now, what's the difference between a best case and a worst case scenario? Best case scenario is going to be where it reaches perigee, all right? And not to be confused with perihelion. Perihelion is where it comes closest to the sun. Perigee is where it comes closest to Earth. You know, all politics are local. So as they say in real estate, location, location, location. And if it reaches perigee, its closest distance to the Earth, when the sun is in between Earth and the Planet X system, then that is a best case scenario flyby. That was Exodus. However, Noah's flood was a worst-case scenario where Earth and the Planet X system were on the same side of the sun when it came to perigee. Now, a lot of folks, you know, when you look at the story of Noah and the flood in the Colburn Bible, it's the story of Sesuda and Hanok. And what we are told is that the flood was caused by 40 days, you know, 40 days and 40 nights of rain. And scientists have said, well, that's nonsense because there's not enough surface water. Well, yeah, that argument, if you're going to be limited that way. But if you're trying to find the truth of the matter, what it really is that's the last of the flyby, the 40 days and 40 nights, because when we pass through the tail of this system, our atmosphere just gets loaded. And so we have a huge period of incredibly heavy rains, and that would cause essentially 40 days and 40 nights. So allegorically, it's correct. It's something that happens after the deluge, not before. So then if it's the 40 days and 40 nights happens after the deluge, where's the deluge coming from? Well, go back and then both the Bible or the Tanakh, that's the five books of Moses. And there you're going to go and have absolute provenance, because that is the very exact Hebrew it was penned in that we read today. So I go to the five books of Moses, the Tanakh or Torah. And that tells us that Noah built the ark on the side of a hill. Now, if you're working with a banker to finance your ark, the logical thing to do is build it in the bay, so that if your disaster doesn't happen, no problemo, turn it into a hotel and casino and you clean up. And, you know, happy ending. On the other hand, if you're having a pole shift event, and a pole shift event is going to be a crustal shift, you're going to have a magnetic where the north and south pole flip. That's a magnetic shift. A crustal shift is where the skin of the planet, the lithosphere, it literally shifts. Now, when that happens, all of the major basins of water, all the major bodies of water come out of their basins. And I've got a guy with a weed blower by me, so I hope it doesn't bother us.
No, can't even hear him.
And the thing about it is that if you are going to have a wall of water because a massive tsunami, mile-high tsunami, is coming because the oceans are being displaced, if it hits a bay, coastal areas, those areas are going to be absolutely devastated. Whatever's there is immediately going to be chewed up to dull rags. But then that massive wave is going to continue inland. Now, as it's crossing over the land, it is losing energy rapidly. And so at some point, that wave will ebb and then return back. By Noah building the ark on the side of a hill, strategically located, the wave that came in from the pole shift, the crustal pole shift, ebbed just as the waters were going underneath the keel of the ark, as opposed to going over the ark and crushing it to pieces. And then the waters lifted the ark off the yokes and drew it out to sea. And so that explains what's going to happen with a pole shift event. Coastal areas are going to be devastated. Now, the question then becomes, in this flyby that we're going to experience, is this is going to be a best-case scenario where Planet X system reaches perigee when the sun is between us? Or is it going to be a worst-case scenario where the sun is not between us, we're both on the same side of the sun? The call was made on that actually in a 2008 interview with Bob Dean. He's a government whistleblower. Highly secure rated. I've had a chance to talk with him. He's a very fine gentleman, upstanding. And his sources were telling him in 2008 that this would be a worst case scenario, that we would both be on the same side of the sun. So we're looking at a pole shift event, which is a direct concern for everyone who lives along coastal areas. And the vast majority of humanity lives in these danger zones.
Well, my goodness. You know, I wonder. No, they can't be that smart. There seems to be this push by government agencies to move people off the coastlines and get them centered in cities that are well inland. They can't be that smart, can they?
Well, what they're doing is you're seeing a lot of government agencies that are relocating inland to the flyover states. And however, what we are seeing, while they're moving government agencies, the thing that they're not doing is they're not moving the general populace off the coastlines. In fact, what I am seeing is a concerted effort by the governments to keep as much of human population as possible on the coastlines, which would therefore create a massive die-off event.
No kidding. You know, that sort of flies in the face of things that have been said about Agenda 21 and so forth, where it at least has sounded like, I mean, according to some of the people we've spoken to, as though they're trying to push them off the coastline. So I don't know. You know, it, and I mean that. I don't know. I'm not contradicting you. It wouldn't. Look, I think this mass die-off is wanted. Pretty sure it is, considering that, you know.
This is, from my, you know, perspective here, and I mean, I've been, my first Planet X article was published in January 2002. I started the research in 2001. Been following it over the years, and I came to understand in about 2004, 2005, what the goal is. And it is to dramatically reduce the population for a very specific purpose. Control. If you look at what are we in right now, we're in a surveillance society. You know, 10-year-old girls are being groped in public by TSA workers.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is humiliating. Everything we do is electronically surveilled. So we don't have any more privacy. We're owned by the state. Now, if you are in a small elite minority, keep in mind, there are 8 people in the world with enough wealth to equal the bottom 3.5 billion put together. Just 8 people. So there's a huge disparity in the distribution of wealth. And you have a small elite that are controlling things. And the folks that we see publicly are the face boys. All right. They're the straw men. The real people that are pulling the strings, that have the real power, they operate in the shadows. Yeah. Now, for them, there's a real crisis that's going to happen during this pole shift in flyby. And that is all of their population control mechanisms are going to be utterly, totally decimated. And on one hand, humanity is going to be suffering terribly. We're going to have huge population losses. But on the other hand, we're going to be dying as free people. All right? That's a first. So once we get to the point where we're at the tail end of this tribulation and the worst part of it, the initial cataclysms, once we're towards the end of that, that's when the elites are going to jump up from their underground bases, and that's when they're going to have an inducement for the survivors. Yeah. And they're going to say, okay, you've made it, you survived the bugs, the bombs, whatever. And we have vast warehouses, underground warehouses loaded with food, seeds, clothing, construction materials, everything you need to get started again. All right?
Yeah.
For example, Svalbard Doomsday Seed Vault up in the Arctic Circle. Mm. Go to their website. And I challenge someone publicly to find on that website a page where it says, we're doing this out of love for our fellow man, and we're going to share all of this freely.
Yeah. What is the website?
It's the Svalbard website, the Doomsday Seed Vault.
Yeah.
And so all they got to do is just go to the Svalbard Seed Vault, find that. It's up in the Arctic Circle. So the point of it is that they're going to have the inducements. And if you have 7 billion people, or say 6 billion people survive the flyby, and you have a limited amount of inducements that would, for example, be enough to make a difference in the lives of everyone on the planet for a week or maybe two, well, that's really not a huge incentive. But if the number of survivors have been dramatically whittled down to 1 in 10, now you have a really strong inducement. So what is the inducement? Well, you say, we're going to open up the bunkers. Everybody gets all of the stuff. You got to be chipped. All right. And that's when it will be the RFID chipping. And these are going to be incredibly sophisticated devices. While they're going to be telling us these are transponders, they're actually going to be transceivers. And they're going to be multi-mode, multi-frequency, and they're going to have the ability to broadcast and receive on multiple frequencies simultaneously. And they're going to be very powerful. You know, think about the Matrix. We learned that the body can generate 100 watts, to light a bulb. All right? Well, we're going to have these transceivers plucked into us. And they're not only going to know where we're at, they're going to know what our mental state of mind is. They're going to be able to use, once they get satellites back up in the sky over our heads, they'll be able to do blanket transmissions and send down neural programming to make people docile. Essentially, electronic Prozac. And then the other thing that is really going to be very disturbing for a lot of people is that they have isolated, we all like to feel that we could talk to God, all right? There's like connect with the other side, that we can feel that greater spiritual presence. Well, they have mapped out those frequencies. And so they'll be able to use these RFID chips, these transceivers, to put up a barrier, an electronic barrier, so we no longer literally can talk to God. And so we'll be completely programmed, Prozac. We're going to be Prozac people. And that means we're going to be very controllable and easy for the elites to manage. And so the bottom line of coming through the Planet X tribulation that's coming ahead is, are we going to survive as a species? Absolutely. Take that to the bank. Are we going to rebuild afterwards? Absolutely. Take that to the bank. Are we going to go to space? Absolutely. Take that to the bank.
Yes.
So then what's the question? If we're going to survive, rebuild, and go to space, what's the question? The question is how will we go to space? Are we going to go as Anunnaki stormtroopers, and that we become a proxy war species? Look at what's happening around the world today. You've got a lot of nations that use proxies to fight their battles for us, for them, and for us. If you're a proxy species, then, you can be sacrificed quite easily, your pawns. Or on the other hand, humanity takes this opportunity of chaos, grabs a hold of it, secures its freedom, and we have a Star Trek future. Gene Roddenberry tapped on something just very deep. Something that's, existential for us is this hope of having this enlightened future. And so that's really the question of what hangs in balance. Do we go out there like Anunnaki stormtroopers, or are we going to have that Star Trek future? And the Star Trek future is really going to be because when the elites come up with their inducements from underground. There are enough people, you're not going to get everybody to do it, but if enough people say no, all right, along the lines of Gandhi or what King taught us about peaceful non-cooperation, you know, don't go violent, don't go attacking, blood will have blood, you're going to lose. But if enough people have the courage to stand up and say no to the inducements, then that could turn the tide. And humanity could come out of this terrible cataclysm. And the worst of it will be for about 3 years, but then it's going to drag on for another 10 years approximately after that, as the Earth settles back down again, because after all of this has happened, the sun will be rising in the west and setting in the east. And so the Earth is going to have to settle. We have whole new entire land masses that'll come up from the ocean floor, and then we're going to have surface areas that are going to sink. So there's a lot of settling, there's a lot of shifting back into place, but over in time, we're going to have those blue skies again. I call that the backside. And my hope is that enough of humanity comes into enlightenment throughout this process to understand what the goal of the elites is, which is to return us to being an enslaved world, and to say, no, peaceful non-cooperation. And that's really where it comes down to. And keep one thing in mind. What is the story of Exodus about? Moses using the flyby, the last flyby of the Planet X system, which created chaos, which destroyed the control mechanisms of the Egyptians so that he could extract the Hebrews from bondage and take them to freedom. Except in the last flyby, it was a people. In this flyby, it could be our species.
Yeah. Wow. Now, there are a few thoughts to think about. Amazing.
Yeah, that'll leave a... That can leave you looking at the ceiling.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah.
Sorry about all this coughing. Our weather situation down here in Texas is just as crazy as always. It was like freezing cold the other day. It felt like it was freezing, but it wasn't. Then, warming period. Then it's like, another cooling period. Then, it warmed up. Then it went cold again. My face just went, my sinuses went, okay, that's it. You're getting a head cold. Do something about this weather, or I'll give you the flu. So, happily, it hasn't done that. So, I'm going to go with the Asian thing that, head cold, body taking opportunity to heal self. I hope that's true. But sorry, anyway. Sorry, I have to put up with that coughing because I can't mute you when I do it. I can mute myself, but not you.
I'm getting over a flu. I understand exactly what you're going through.
Yeah, I'm getting more like Mr. Hughes every day. Oh, you're a human. Stay away. You have germs. Doesn't do much for your social life. I'll tell you that.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
That was a guy that could live off a can of soup for 3 days.
Yeah.
But what was it? His favorite film was Ice Station Zebra.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, how'd that go work out after a month, I wonder? I've lost weight. Yeah, I bet you have. I can't think straight. Yeah, I bet you can't. Oh, boy. Now, why don't we just jump into the part that's going to grab people the most? I mean, this is really heady stuff, Marshall. And but everybody wants to know. There are two things that seem to be just inherent in every human being. Number one, we don't want change. And the other is, well, be that as it may, we want to survive when it comes, which we know it will, even though we don't want it. But I repeat, it will come. So what is the trick to surviving this? I mean, do you just take everything underground? I keep thinking of that Nicolas Cage movie. Isn't it remarkable to me that he's had such a career is amazing. That picture, Knowing.
Yeah, Knowing.
Yeah.
You know, and he was saying you got to be 2 miles underground.
Was that all?
Which was interesting because that's where all the deep underground military bases are, about 2 miles underground.
Yeah. You got to be 2 miles underground.
To survive the kind of events that you see in Knowing.
Yeah.
And I believe that this will be the last survivable flyby of this system. That we're not going to have, and that, you know, the sequence at the end of Knowing is gut-wrenching when you just see this Earth just scorch the surface of the planet.
Yeah.
And the sun just, you know, a huge solar storm hits it and tears it up. We're not going to have that this time. That's not, you know, in my book, Being in It for the Species, The Universe Speaks. It lays out a very specific sequence of events, all right? But we're not going to have something along the lines of what you saw in Noah. On the other hand, the next time, 3,600 years from now, when it comes around, and it could be even sooner because the orbit could become erratic, a little more erratic from this, and that's what happens with steeply inclined orbits, is that it could be what Nostradamus forecasted, all right? That in about 1,800 years from now, the planet is just scorched and becomes lifeless. That would be a Knowing sequence. That's what the elites are preparing for with their bunkers being 2 miles underground, because they've really been working on this for about a half a century. What they didn't expect when they were doing their initial planning was the phenomena of sinkholes. And yes, there's always been sinkholes in Florida and a few other places, but now we're seeing sinkholes where we've never seen them before. And you can have a really cool, deep underground military base, and if a sinkhole opens up under it, that whole base becomes compromised. And they're not going to do as well underground as we would have think. Now, we're going to know dying time is near very easily. And that is when the tarmac at Denver International Airport is littered with private jets like a bad case of the measles. Mm-hmm. And when you start seeing Gulfstreams and Citations and Lears lined up as far as the eye can see, that's it. You know, get the guest room ready. Hell's coming to visit, and it's going to be a long stay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, for those that are in planning and preparation, who's going to get through it? And I have spent years talking with people, and it's a very frustrating thing because if you're not faced with the clear and present danger, you're seeing your own mortality, all right? Or in the case of this, it'll be when folks are standing out on the street with their family, friends, and neighbors pointing up at the sky and pooping their collective pants.
Yes.
You know, this is when you're having the conversation. Fellas, you ever seen anything like that? No, George, never did, you know. And when we're having those kind of conversations, the fear that's going to be gripping people's throats is not going to be the fear of what they're seeing. It's going to be the fear that comes from knowing they're not prepared for what they're seeing.
Oh yeah.
And they're going to understand that this is going to be a lengthy tribulation just by looking at it. Now, what I will tell you to expect is that when these things show up in the sky, they come out from behind the sun, all right, and everyone's seeing it. And we're getting all kinds of observation reports, get them all the time. There's a lot of disinformation that's being pumped out there, a lot of photoshopping. These are this is being done intentionally to prevent people from coming to consensus. Because if people cannot come to consensus about a commonly perceived threat, they're not going to take action on it. And remember, the goal of the elites is to keep as many people living where they're at so they'll die in place on the coastlines. And as a matter of fact, when I, you know, if you were to take the denial meter is people who go, it's nonsense, nothing's going to happen, and I don't want to hear about it. That's the denial meter. And you in the flyover states, you know, it'll jump back and forth. You get to the coastlines, pegs it right into the red. Boom, 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 boom. Because that's where the heavy neuro-linguistic programming disinformation activities are directed. They want to keep the people on the coastlines. And that's why we're also starting to see restrictions in travel. It's, you know, for example, in Europe, you can't cross borders now without getting stopped. And you have to have identity. They go through your luggage. It's pretty intense on the ground, just as intense on the ground now as it is going through an airport.
Yeah, it is.
And they're just acclimating us to the closures. Now, they're not going to close borders and tell people you can't move inland because of Planet X. They just would create a stampede. But if they have another threat, an ISIS, terror events, or something like that that's unrelated, then you're not going to have the stampede. So what we can expect to see is when folks are standing out in the front yard and they're pointing at this, we'll have experts on CNN and other places telling us that it's just an interesting light show. Don't worry about it. And, you know, it'll have a little bit of disruption with communications from time to time and some other things. But it's a comet with a red tail, and it's just going to fly by. And a lot of people are just going to believe that because that's what they're going to want to hear. All right? I mean, you ask these same people, do you believe your government is entirely honest with you about everything? They're all going to go, I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. Of course they're not. And then they'll say, but with something this big, they'd have to be honest. Well, my answer to that assumption is, where is that written? I mean, is it in the Bible? Is it in the Constitution? Is it in the IRS tax code? I mean, where is it written that at some point a government that is lying to its people is all of a sudden going to have a sense of shame and conscience, and they're going to come forward and say, here's what the real deal is? And that's just a naive assumption. And so a lot of people are just going to say, well, then it's just a light show and go on, and it's going to be all the bravado and the hubris. Then we're going to start having more natural disasters, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes. Things are going to start unnerving people. They're going to start feeling things are not quite right. And that's interesting because I saw that happening this summer. I've been doing a lot of traveling to go out and do what we call a regional reconnaissance for different areas for relocation for communities. And one of the areas went up into was in the Northwest, Eastern Washington, North Idaho, Northwest, Montana, but especially in Washington State and also in Oregon. And every chance I had during the trip, I was asking people, you know, how's the weather? Just like that. How's the weather? And there was none of the flip hubris of, well, bad year, next year is better, we'll get rains, whatever. No, they have been seeing continuing drought, longer fire seasons, more violent fire seasons. Things are getting progressively worse. And they were saying, I don't know what's wrong, but the earth is sick and it's not getting better.
Yeah.
And I don't know where this is going, and I'm troubled by that. And so are you going to hear about this in the media, which is focused on what happens on the East Coast? No. Media does, our media, corporate media, is very well controlled. So that information is not getting out, what's happening with people. We're going to have that. People are going to really sense that something's coming. But then they're going to be clinging to, it's just going to be an interesting light show, so don't worry about it. Until finally something happens and they really start to get scared. And at that point, then the talking heads come out for one last shot to say, okay, we didn't calculate this into our projections, and we apologize for that. We have revised our projections, and we believe that this is the worst of it that has already passed. All right? And what will happen is people will latch on to that. You know, like mice clinging to the straws in the midst of a flood. And that will be the last one, because after that, then things are going to get worse, and whoever's in the wrong place is just in the wrong place, and they're going to die badly.
Oh boy.
And they'll be led to their death. There will be people who are going to say, all right, I believe my lying eyes. I'm going to take action. I'm going to do something. And I believe at this point, with a very narrow window of opportunity for folks in the mainstream, when I look at what I call the 2%ers, the top 2% income bracket, I mean, I've been talking to those folks for years. They've got their bunkers. They're all in position. I mean, you'd have to really look hard to find one of them that doesn't have a personal deep underground condominium, and they will sit through the tribulation in their hot tubs watching The Sound of Music on their big screens and eating their MREs. Trust me on that one. Ask them about it, and they're going to say, it's all nonsense, nothing's going to happen, and I don't want to hear about it. Okay? They got their bunkers. I'm talking about folks in the mainstream who are buying into the nonsense that on something this big, the government would have to tell us. Whose government? We don't own our government anymore.
Right.
Okay? We don't own it. So I believe the church, the groups that are going to have the greatest ability to respond in what I call rapid deployment survival communities will be faith-based organizations, particularly churches. All right. The reason why is these organizations have three significant advantages. First advantage is that they have an established chain of command, a leadership. That's not to say that they're not going to be political, everything is, but they are going to have an accepted chain of command. That's a huge advantage, because this is the number one reason why egalitarian survival communities tend to fail, because they get into power grabs. And also, same thing for the materially oriented preppers that are, you know, the guys that run around in the middle of the night with their AR-15s practicing for whatever. And all of these people get into power grabs. So you're not going to have the likelihood of a power grab fracturing a community and dividing loyalties. The second thing a church is going to have is, while times are good, you know, passing around the basket can take a long time to keep the bills paid. In times of disaster, these organizations have a unique advantage in terms of marshaling resources and people very quickly. They take care of things. For example, we hear about all of the money that our governments are spending around the world to help people in crisis in the third world and so forth. But the fact is, more is being done for these people by NGOs, non-governmental organizations, than all the governments put together. And, you know, folks just helping others for a noble reason, being in service to humanity. So these folks will pull together, marshal their resources. The third advantage of a church is diversity of background. You go to pray with everybody, and the person sitting in front of you could be a doctor, the one to the left of you, an engineer, a lawyer, a sanitation worker. You don't know where these people come from, their walks of life. But they're going to come from many different walks of life, and it's this diversity of skill sets that's going to be immensely valuable in creating the communities. But also, you have extended liaison networks. So you have a sanitation worker who also is a ham radio buff and knows a bunch of ham radio operators. You know, could be that that attorney that's sitting next to you is gone through the CERT program, the Citizen Emergency Response Teams, and they bring that kind of background to it. You know, other folks around you, former military, all different kinds of diversities in terms of skill sets that can come to it. So right now, those are the groups that I see are going to do the best in terms of dealing with the physical challenges of it. But more importantly, it's the spiritual and emotional challenges. Here's where the traditional preppers that I see out there, I call them bunker bunnies, the me and mine guys that are saying, I'm going to get my little, you know, 20 acres, and I'm going to have my bunker for me and my family, and everybody else can take care of themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Bunker bunnies. Well, I like that. That's
bunker bunnies.
Yeah.
And I call them bunker bunnies because they're going to become a food source. During a tribulation, you're going to have devolving human beings. You're going to have people that lose their humanity. You're going to have cannibals, but also rabies will become a problem, and people who have rabies are going to become called biters. They'll be dangerous. So then you're going to have gangs, you're going to have all kinds of criminal elements. A lot of these will be swept aside by the worst of the pole shift events, namely the Great Winnowing. It's going to eradicate most of these. But you're still going to have to deal with them, and these folks are going to be in underground bunkers. Well, they typically have 1 to 2 years of supply of food. And also keep in mind that when they set those food supplies, they were using optimistic calculations. And the fact is, when people are under a huge amount of stress, they're going to eat more, going to require more calories. You go down into the bunker and, you know, fine, you spend a few days, a week, everybody's attaboy, pats on the back, aren't we clever? Then what happens is things start to get bad, and all of the commercial media goes off the air. And here's where, and I think this is a very important thing, if somebody is out there right now saying, what could I do today to help me and my family get through this?
Yeah.
Get a ham radio license. I'm serious. For about $200, you can get a radio, you can get a license. Most importantly, you're going to be able to interface with a lot of people who are devoted enthusiasts, share a lot of knowledge. And the reason why I say this is because, and there's the ARRL, okay, that's the main organization, and their motto is, when all else fails, amateur radio. Think about what happens in all the floods and disasters, and FEMA's communication shuts down like it did in Katrina.
Yeah.
It was amateur radio operators that saved the day.
That's right.
Amateur radio is going to be the difference between us having a Mad Max reality and some modicum of hope.
Yeah, that's
it
really
will
true.
Be the deciding technology.
And, you know, for people who are kind of rolling their eyes going, oh, man, come on. It's like you can't believe the interesting stuff that you learn when you get into those books and start studying it. Because, I mean, you have to sit down with and start reading it. But if you do, Even if you get a book on improvised antennas or stuff that you can take into the field, like you got your little backpack of radio and need to put up an antenna, what you learn about everything from stuff coming into your little radio shack area to get you, as in RF, to what times of day you can broadcast on certain bandwidths, it gives you a window into the electromagnetic force that surrounds us and penetrates us and binds the universe together. That'll be one thing, you know. And it's cool. It really does open a window to just a different look at the world, and you'll enjoy it. Not to mention, I got off track here a little bit, Marshall, but and they're definitely good for survival applications. But when you learn what you're doing and the kind of forces that you're playing with, it's fun. I mean, it really is. But again, it requires study.
And, you know, I got my technician license and my call sign. My fiance Jennifer not only got her technician, she went next step. She went to general, so that she can do high frequency and DX around the world, mm-hmm. and which I think is important. I'm going to go for my general in February, and I think that's a good goal for everyone to do. And particularly I want to say to the ladies out there, this is not something that, yeah, it's a male-dominated hobby, but ladies, when things start to unfold, you're going to be principally in the bunker. You're going to be at the center of things. We're going to have that return to traditional roles, and the guys are going to be out foraging and hunting around for whatever they can find. Now, do you want to sit there in silence and wonder and pray and not know what's happening to your loved ones? Or do you want to be able to key a mic and say, hey, radio check, come back at me, all right? And know that they're out there, know what's going on. And the important thing for you ladies is that now is a golden opportunity to become a ham radio operator. And the reason why is that ever since the introduction of smartphones, it has caused a huge demographic imbalance. 20-somethings and 30-somethings that are typically the youth of amateur radio are not coming in as they did before, because they have these gadgets that do everything and will stop doing everything after the cell phone system collapses. And that only takes about 3 days for the fuel to go out on the generators.
Yeah.
And the result is, if you're going to amateur radio meetings, what you're seeing is a whole lot of silverbacks like me, all right, and older folks. And there's a dearth of this younger group, and particularly with women. And if you're a woman and you show up and you have a genuine interest, you're not going to this because your husband does it and you just want to hang out with your husband. You're doing it because you're interested. You have a dog in the fight, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, they're going to lay out the carpet for you, and they're going to be happy to just share all kinds of knowledge, help you with all kinds of things. The information you'll get is going to be invaluable. And so for those of you ladies out there who are going, well, what could I start doing right now that would make a difference for my family during the tribulation? Get a ham radio license. Okay, because this is, if you go out and you start buying cases of beans and putting them in the garage, you're going to get your head handed to you. But on the other hand, when groups of people are starting to form up to start survival communities, what you want is a skill set that's going to make you worth your weight in beans. And if you can walk in and you go, here's my call sign, and I know these people, and I know these people, and I can get equipment here and antennas there, I'm connected to all these fabulous human resources. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, the girls are, you know, I am not a woman, and I do not know how women think. I get an insight into it every once in a while, but I don't know. I roll with what martial arts Mesta said, which is woman completely different from man. And that's all he would ever say about it. And I went, okay, that pretty much says it all, doesn't it, Master? And it does. But I got to tell you, the women are rising. They're like, to hell with feminism. It's not helping anything. It's stupid. I mean, they really are. It's not that they're taking back their power. They never lost their power. It's like Dame Diana Rigg said. She was never a feminist. She said, well, I've always thought that women were in the stronger position. And Dame Diana is exactly right. And, I mean, these women are, I mean, you give a woman who's never shot a rifle before and she'll put the bullet right in the X-ring every time, first shot. Well, I've never shot before. Well, just look down the sights and do it. The guys are standing around like, oh, my gosh, she can shoot. And they'll make these dumbass jokes like, oh, men make big mistake, teach women how to shoot. It's like, what? Only if you're afraid that she's going to keep your dumbass in line. Are you familiar with that? That's a scientific term, Marshall. Dumbass? Kidding you. Let me ask you a question.
Really?
What is behind the name of your... what's behind the name of your website? Y-O-W-U-S-A. Yowza. What's up with that? I looked, but I couldn't get a clue, so...
It's Your Own World, USA.
Okay, gotcha.
And actually, Yowza started out as a travel business. And I was doing tours to Russia after Russia opened up in the 90s. That's how I wound up getting into this in the first place. Because right after Russia opened up in the early 90s, I was going every December and returning every January. Because as a tour operator, I had to go get everything set up for my summer seasons. And I would take Aeroflot and fly from San Francisco to Moscow over the pole. Going, it was always at night, but on the way back was always during the day. And in the early 90s, it was the very first time I saw the Arctic. And I'm sitting there in the Aleutian 62, which is still my favorite thing to fly in. I think it's a wonderful jet. And honest to God, the Russian passenger jets are more comfortable than American.
Oh, man, their stuff is so cool looking, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the lots of leg room, lots of headroom, passenger comfort. You're not spamming a can. And I'm sitting there looking through the window from horizon to horizon, the very first time I saw the Arctic, and I was just mesmerized because I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yep.
All right. Snow was something you went somewhere else to go skiing in.
Sure.
And it was also the first time that I saw blue ice, which is very old ice. I mean, I saw blue ice was when I was in Phoenix because you went to 7-Eleven and they put a cone with crushed ice in it and blue syrup, and that was your blue ice.
Right, yeah.
But I saw it, and the very first time I saw the Arctic, it was just, it was mesmerizing, breathtaking, unblemished, beautiful, pure, from, you know, horizon to horizon. And then over the years, as I was traveling, same time, always coming back in early February, about mid-February, and seeing the Arctic, and it just slowly deteriorated year after year. I saw it, you know, over a period of 8 years. And it was never something, well, it's seasonal, highs and lows, natural variations, fluctuations, all these were ways to rationalize it. Nah, it just was, just, that's it, Harry, we're going in, feather one, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a standard, you know, slip slide into misery, and I'll never forget the last time. And I looked at it, and it really almost made me want to cry.
Yeah.
Because the Arctic looked like a busted windshield of a car in a wrecking yard.
No kidding.
It was all broken up, just looked awful. And I remember that last trip, and I knew it was my last trip. And just thinking to myself, all right, so all of the paid experts who are being paid by the energy companies are telling us, no, there's no such thing as weather weirding, global, you know, global warming, whatever you want to call it these days.
Weather weirding, I think, is better than all of them.
Yeah, weather weirding is a good one. And, but I'm just going, you know, I believe my lying eyes. I'm seeing it with my own eyes.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, it's funny. You look back on episodes of your life, and having the travel business to Russia was amazing. I did things, saw things, went places that no other Americans could see, go, or do. And it just was an incredible adventure. And there were a lot of things that happened in my life, but when I look back on it, all of that to me now, I understand all of that was context. That the reason why I was doing that business was Creator wanted me to be in that airplane every February looking at what was happening to our planet.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Really.
And, you know, that was it. God just said, there you go. This is what I want you to see so that you know, you understand. And I see how the media is so heavily manipulated these days. I mean, when I was working with CNN, they had a science feature department. They don't, haven't had one for a decade. And now we don't have a media. I mean, back then, CNN was a lean, mean news machine. Now it's basically an American Pravda.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it is. And Fox didn't any better. All they do is sit around there and talk over each other. I mean, I can't take it for more than 2 minutes. It's like, does everybody have to talk at once? It's just stupid. And it's almost like, oh, we're copping to what's going on in Europe with the refugees and migrants. And we didn't see it coming. You know, we had no, it's just like, it's useless. It's nothing but a platform to sell product on. You know, I ask you what Yowza stood for because, this program is being rebroadcast, delayed, and condensed, and they may not have access to a guest media unless they become members, which, of course, we hope that you do. There are almost 450 programs in archive right now. You talk about the deal of the century. I'm not kidding you. So if you're hearing this rather than seeing it and hearing it, you know, come on. Don't be so tight. It's not only inexpensive, it's downright cheap. You know, it's interesting that you should have mentioned ice. Ladies and gentlemen, you know how you get across thin ice, don't you? Dance, dance, dance. Be right back.
This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Here is John B.
All right, Marshall, we have not gotten into the Planet 7X theories versus Zachariah Sitchin's work. So, in the words of every veteran showman all through history, take it away.
All righty. And, there's a tendency, because Sitchin passed away in 2010, a lot of folks want to make their bones on Sitchin's reputations by disparaging him. And what folks really need to understand is that if you hear somebody telling you that Planet X is an internet hoax, like Snopes, and it's like, I wouldn't call Snopes a reliable source, but you're going to hear that. And the fact is, the father of Planet X research in America was Percival Lowell. He was looking for Planet X. That's how they found Pluto. They thought Pluto was Planet X. And it wasn't until much, much later, 70 years I mean, back, I think, in the 70s or something, they discovered Pluto's moon, Charon, and were able to determine it didn't have the mass to be Neptune's perturber or Planet X. Planet X is simply a term used in astronomy to say, we know there's an object out there by means of the way it interacts with other objects we can observe, but we haven't seen it yet. And the very first planet discovered with a telescope was Uranus. However, Neptune was not discovered with a telescope. It was discovered with mathematics. They were observing Uranus, and they could see perturbations in its orbits, little zigs, if you will.
Yeah.
And they were then able to mathematically locate Neptune. John Gall in Berlin, he took the equations and boom, dialed it right up. Perfect. Spot on. Found Neptune. Percival Lowell was looking for it, and he actually imaged it in 1915, but didn't know it. That time, he didn't perceive Pluto as a planet. Tom Baugh did that with his observations. But Percival Lowell is the father of Planet X research. And Neptune was discovered by the Europeans, and it was the first Planet X, and the term just came into use. So it has a long history. Now, in the last century, you had Percival Lowell, and you have Velikovsky. And then Velikovsky's reputation was tainted and smeared, even though he was a good friend of Albert Einstein, and Einstein was reading his book, Worlds in Collision, at the time that he passed away, and it was on his desk. Then along comes Zachariah Sitchin, and Sitchin translated the Sumerian texts, and he did a brilliant job of it. I had the opportunity to actually know Sitchin, work with him, and to have a feel for the man and his integrity as a researcher. And this was a fellow that there was nothing speculative about him. He dotted his I's and crossed his T's. And the first time I came to know Sitchin was actually, we published an article, an exclusive interview with Sitchin on Yowza.com, and this was back in 2002, as I recall. Nancy Leader of Zeta Talk and a fellow by the name of Mark Hazelwood, who had pirated a lot of Nancy Leader's work, were predicting that there would be a major catastrophic flyby of Planet X in 2003. And we didn't see, at Yowza, we didn't see any of that. So we were just calling it Zeta hysteria. And Sitchin got my telephone number from a mutual friend and reached out to me. And it was a Sunday morning. You know, it's like 8 o'clock in the morning, and God, did I have the mother of all tequila hangovers. Oh! And I'm like, and the phone rings, and it's like, do I reach for it? Phone keeps ringing. Okay, hello? Hello, this is Zachariah Sitchin in New York. Is this Marshall Masters? Man, hangover gone. Boy, you talk about a cinematic moment.
Oh, yeah.
What he told me was that he was really concerned. He was, there were people that were blaming the 2003 Zeta hysteria on his book, The Lost Book of Enki, which he'd published, and his book was selling very briskly as a result of that. And he was totally opposed to it. He said, these people are completely wrong. This leader is totally wrong. And he offered to give me an exclusive interview, and we published that interview. And boy, I'll tell you, I gave him editorial control over the article. And after, you know, umpteen-nine editorial review cycles. I said, that's it. We're done. We're going to press. And I worked with him on a few other projects afterwards and just really came to respect his work. And what I would tell your audience out there is if there's one book by Zachariah Sitchin you want to read, it's Lost Book of Enki. Because Lost Book of Enki is the autobiography of Lord Enki of the Anunnaki. Simply put, humanity came from this man's loins. All right? And Enki of the Anunnaki is the missing link. Period. It took the ancient hominids. We were genetically modified to become working creatures to go out and mine gold. Because today, for our geoengineering, where we have all the jets spraying us, we use aluminum to modify our atmosphere. The Anunnaki use gold. It's not a currency thing. It's not a wealth thing. And so Sitchin was always, for me, just a man who, his integrity was unimpeachable. And unfortunately, his views steps on the toes of a lot of people with very devout religious beliefs who just go, what do you mean? We weren't created by God. We were created by some guy by the name of Lord Enki, the Anunnaki, who wanted to create, you know, a slave race of gold miners, which is exactly what that story is. And then for those of you, by the way, who enjoy Game of Thrones on HBO, The Lost Book of Enki is Game of Thrones with spaceships and horny aliens. You know, it makes Farscape look like, you know, Mary Poppins.
Right.
And so his book was coming out. It was getting propelled. We did this. And I have seen over the years, the people that go out to besmirch his reputation are coming from a very strong religious point of view. And the most latest is Gil Broussard, runs Planet 7X. And I saw him in an interview on the Watchers series, which is produced by Pinlight Productions. And I appeared in several different Watchers productions. And I saw them interviewing him, and the first question was, you know, about Zachariah Sitchin. And they said, you know, everyone stands on his shoulders. And Broussard said, well, nobody vetted his work, and the attack was very general and dismissive. And so I took exception to that. I posted a video on YouTube called Planet 7X Theories versus Zachariah Sitchin's work. And I go through the whole thing about Broussard with Planet 7X. And there's no scientific basis for the term Planet 7X. You know, I was telling you before when we were talking about Percival Lowell and the history of the term Planet X, that there's a very, very strong history, scientific history in that term. Planet 7X is something Broussard created because he just says, well, it's seven times the size of the Earth. But he also says no one's seen it, that there have been no credible sightings or observations of Planet X or Planet 7X, but he says it's 7X, so it's a guess. So how do you create a scientific designation based on a guess? The only reason why you're going to do that is if you want to create confusion in the discussion out there. And we look at it as researchers, and we downloaded his timeline file. It's a huge PDF of 52 PDF graphics. And what I detail in the video is that he says, he makes the claim, his tagline is using science to prove the Bible. But you can't use science to prove what he's saying because you can't follow his work. all of the text is summarized in his graphics, and it's embedded in the graphics, so it can't be extracted. You can't find where he's got his research notes, his articles, you know, how he came to this. So there's no substance behind the graphics. They're presented as is. The presentation is very brilliant, very expensive. And when I look at that, it makes me wonder and ask the same question other Planet X researchers are asking us. Who paid for it? Because I'm a publisher myself, and I'm a small publisher, admittedly, but I understand what goes in with graphics and doing illustrations and book covers and things like that. But also, I'm a former systems analyst in Silicon Valley. My clients included Lockheed Martin, AT&T, Oracle, Sun Microsystems, Hewlett-Packard, go on down the list. And I understand what it takes to develop a presentation like what he has. That's a team effort. If it's one man and he is an incredibly gifted graphics designer, he could do it in a year to a year and a half. And Broussard says he's a graphics designer, and he makes that claim, yet when I go to research him, you can't find an online portfolio. You can't find a list of clients. You can't find anything other than in a couple of social media sites, he makes the claim to be a graphics designer. And then what he says is that he was able to get that much work out because he had the help of family and some interns in the college. Well, I've been working with those kind of graphics that he has in his timeline for many years. No ham and egg is going to do that. Those graphics are of professional quality. I'm talking about the big four publishers who are going after, for example, home study and for library market. And because these are very, very intricate, very integrated graphics, very elegant. And something like that takes a team effort and an awful lot of money, and you have to have professional talent, someone who is very well trained on how to use a tool like Photoshop, not someone who bought it and played around with it over the weekend, but somebody who really knows how to do something with it. And there's no provenance, there's no substance to his claims that he's a graphics designer. He can't prove how these things are done. And so he doesn't provide the research to back it up. He's very popular because he's talking to the Christian audience. All right. And, you know, I posted this video and I just go through and I'm asking logical questions based on statements he made in an interview in the Watcher series. And, you know, I don't have public voting where people can see the vote counts, but, you know, it's more than 2-1 in my favor in terms of people seeing how I'm presenting and questioning the work that he's doing. And it makes me wonder, you know, earlier I told you you're going to have the government coming out with talking heads and saying, don't worry, it's just a red-tailed comet in the sky. All right? Well, what is media going to do, the controlled media? Now, people are going to say, well, you know, can we really trust the government? So what are they going to do, parade out a whole bunch of conspiracy theorists to challenge what the government position is? But what if that's already been thought of by the elites and these alleged conspiracy theorists that they're going to parade out are going to come out with all kinds of crazy theories? But in the final analysis, you know, it's like talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll to a priest. You're going to come back to the papal line. All right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I look at that, and those are the concerns that I have, that I'm not necessarily saying that that's what he's going to do, but this kind of work could be used to lead people into making a fatal mistake, which is not doing something. All right. I mean, for me, if you want one simple difference between me and Broussard, my message when it comes to planning and preparation is, why in the hell are you not doing it if you're not doing it right now? Period. Get off your butt. Just do it. That's me. Yeah. Broussard, maybe not. If you want to do it, why not? Of course. But he doesn't have a real clear position on, you got to take action and do something. And
so many people don't, Marshall.
That's what disturbs me. Huh?
I'm sorry. That's what you say. That's what disturbs you. And it does, because it's I wonder. I wonder if there's anything that can be done other than go through some motions, because we really don't know what the actual form will be. We don't know what the effect is going to be, what form the future will take, and what psychological effect it will have on people who behold it. As far as mainstream media is concerned, they are a total non-entity now, and I think they should just be discounted. In fact, I think in their present form, I'm pretty sure they're not going to like this, but, forget about it. They should be relegated to the dustbin of history, the dustbin, not the archives. It's useless.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they're less than useless. I mean, they're going to be used to, people are going to turn to Fox and CNN and MSNBC, which are basically demographic markets. They're
absolutely
not competing news entities.
No. No, well, it makes no difference whether it's the left or the right. It's like they're reading from the same script. I've said this many times. Sometimes the news reports, I mean, the words are the same. So where'd they get, who printed the sheet off?
Yeah, they're just, tweaking the message for their demographic. And so, and I agree with you completely. Maybe we'll see them doing some last-ditch effort to redeem themselves. But it really is going to boil down to people who are going to be prepared to think for themselves and to take action. And, it's one of the things that I've done with my fiance, Jennifer. We started a non-denominational teaching church because, as I explained before, churches are going to have the best ability to respond quickly in a rapid deployment in a narrow window of time. So by having a non-denominational teaching church, what we really want to do is it's an outreach working with these other churches and helping them to help themselves and to save their, save lives. And when I first came into this research, John, I was born hard geek,
yeah.
Spock wannabe. Live long and prosper. Logic is tweeting bird. That was me. And if you ask me about any of this stuff, I say, oh man, I don't need to hear about the princess who shoots the golden arrow into the sky and kills the hoochie coochie monster.
Right.
I was real, real hard and cynic. And what I came to find was that there's no way to find hope in that mind view. That if you come at it purely from a standpoint of beans, bullets, and bunkers, you're ultimately going to fail, because we're looking at a period of, anywhere from 7 to 12 years of hardship. After that, we will have blue skies once again, and we will eventually have a beautiful planet again. So, it's not this total Mad Max reality. But getting there is going to be a lot of hardship. And what's going to pull people through is patience and fortitude. And particularly three things. One, self-sufficiency knowledge. Two, hope for the future. And three, knowing you are not alone. If people have those three things, all right, that's going to give them a reason to get up in the morning and take on one more day. And it's going to be one day after another of difficult, if not impossible, decisions.
Oh, yes.
But we can pull together. And we, in the hardship, you know, when things are at their worst, we really are at our best. And so, yeah, there's a dark cloud coming. I've been talking about it for years. Wake up and smell the coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the My thing focus is, right now is on that silver lining.
Yeah, well, you know, man, the that box of MREs and the deer rifle in the tent. I was just thinking, and people have been hearing me cough throughout this program. Again, I apologize for that. I'm trying to make it as quiet as possible, and it ain't really happening. But ain't. There's a word I like to use every once in a while just to keep it alive. But you know, not because it's good English. But the thing is when you get something like one of those, just a head cold, your sinuses are throbbing. You're going, oh, my gosh, you know, and you're... Your muscles are aching, your thighs and your backside, and your calves, and you're just all of this. And you think all your familiar conveniences, shall we call them, are really necessities like heating and air conditioning, running water, food availability, medical help, all those things. Suddenly all those things are gone, and now you're put in a position of having to move with 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 other people and not be a drag on them. And you don't feel very good. I mean, we think we're just going to take on this poop storm with a smile and a determined attitude, and we're going to just feel great and we'll be in tip-top shape. But when other things like, you know, the thorn in your finger that's now getting infected and you don't have any antibiotics, and before long, if this isn't stopped, it's going to turn into gangrene. Somebody's going to have to take the campsite hatchet to it. Then there's the tetanus component. It's like there is no way to be ready for everything and go it on your own. You can't do it.
You can't do it. You're absolutely right. That's the reason why my philosophy is that surviving this is not about holding on to things. It's about holding on to each other.
Yes.
And, you know, right now I'm working on my next book, which is going to be titled Surviving the Planet X Tribulation, the first solution for the last to know. And I'm taking it from a viewpoint, I'm talking to the leader of a church, who all of a sudden is, I got to get my flock to safety. And walking that person through all the decision processes, things that you can glom onto, things that you can do, doable things, rapidly doable things. And for me, the three most important survival skills, all right, are invention, insight, and initiative, all right? And so we think about, oh my gosh, our technology is going to disappear. I'm seeing a renaissance. I mean, stop and think about it. Right now, we have so many wonderful people who are inventing holistic cures for cancer, free energy devices, and so forth. And what happens to them? You know, they commit suicide by stabbing themselves in the back 17 times.
Right.
All right. What happens when all of a sudden all of these elitist control mechanisms and the government goons that serve their agenda are no longer busting into civilian laboratories, you know, and just taking everything in sight and arresting honest, hardworking people on absolute nonsense charges and then grinding their lives to pieces through a legal system that's designed to grind people's lives to pieces for the benefit of the elites who hold the controlling levers. All of that's gone. And then all of a sudden, we have Nikola Tesla's popping up everywhere. And they're finding solutions, simple solutions that make a real difference for people's lives. Then it's about getting that knowledge out there, sharing it with others. Self-sufficiency knowledge. And with self-sufficiency knowledge, people will have hope for the future. Sitting like a bunker bunny, and you're down in your bunker, and every time you hear one of the motors in your equipment room start to rattle about, getting unnerved, or all of a sudden everyone starts to think they hear the sound of picks and shovels overhead, all right? Instead of living like that, you know, you're solving problems, you're pulling together, you're celebrating life. There's a noble purpose to what you're doing. And that's the vision that I'm trying to share with people, is that, okay, let's have that noble vision. Let's say we're going to go through this, and the goal of this is that humanity is free and has that Star Trek future. And how do you become a part of that? Well, you ask God. You've got to get on your knees and you got to pray. And you got to find that connection, just you and Creator, one-on-one. How can I serve the plan? How can I move the ball forward? How can I help this species become something more than it has been before? To get through this for a purpose, instead of us wind up becoming, you know, proxy soldiers for bizarre, you know, gold-lusting aliens or whatever dark future the elites have in store for us. And, you know, if you want to see what that future looks like, you go to the movies.
Yeah.
Hunger Games. That's the world that the elites are planning for us to when we come out of this. That's what they want us to have.
Well, we've had about enough of that stuff, though. You know, Marshall, I think we've had about enough of that, just like this bunch up at the UN. In my opinion, the UN needs to be dismantled and destroyed. And can reconvene somewhere else to get together and discuss potential problems. But as far as this bunch of bastards, if you'll excuse the expression, deciding what our fate will be and how we shall live and whether we'll be able to protect ourselves or arm ourselves or do any of these things, I say to hell with these people. They've had their run, these elites and their families that carry on their heinous crimes against humanity, the chief lubricant being, of course, money. It's over with. These people are not going to make it. They're really not. People have had just about enough of this. But what we need to do, and it sounds a little draconian, but the savages who are trying to destroy Europe right now, they need to be neutralized. And the elites who are orchestrating it need to be neutralized and leave the ones in the middle to sort it out. Because we're the ones who always have to sort it out. We're the ones who have to clean up their messes. We're the ones who have to bleed because of the problems they create. And I don't know, Marshall, I just think we're just at the point where it's about to be, here, gloves are coming off, and we're just going to stomp you into a greasy spot on the pavement. It's over with. You know, we're all finished talking. You're coming down out of that treehouse, and we're going to tear your castle down, and you with it.
History is going to do that for us. The Planet X flyby is going to completely fracture their control systems.
Good.
Let me share with you something, because I, you know, it was back about in 2005 that I came to the realization of what the real purpose of all this is, which is to depopulate the planet, get us down to very small, manageable numbers. If they want a large population on the Earth after that, you know what? Just give us a case of Ripple wine and some Viagra. We could work wonders. All right. But I was just so depressed realizing that. And there was this young lady, well, young, she was in her early 40s, and she was a channeler and worked with her. And we were at a very scientific method to how we did it. And we would vet all of the entities that we connected with, and they all vetted. We would ask them to give us a weather event 6 to 12 months out, and they would give us a weather event, and sure enough, it would always happen. It would be a typhoon in one place or a hurricane in another, something like that. But I was really down in the dumps one day, and I called her and was talking about this. And she said, well, let me just see, throw it out there and see who comes in. And so she did. And next thing I know, I'm talking to this guide, Serapis Bay. Funny thing is, you can find him on Wikipedia. Serapis Bay was an ancient priest in Egypt, temple priest. And this is his thing. It's his bag. And so here was what Serapis Bay told me that day, and it was a pivotal turning point in my life that gave me hope. And Serapis Bay said, Marshall, humanity is a big book, and the book is far from being finished. It has many blank pages, as many chapters. This chapter belongs to the elites. You're not going to take it away from them, so don't bother trying. Don't bother complaining. Just don't try. It's theirs, and it's theirs permanently. But this chapter, which they own completely, like all chapters in all books, as do all books, eventually comes to an end. And this chapter is in its last pages. The next chapter does not belong to them. They know that. And they know that the only way they can transfer their control of your species from this chapter to the next chapter, because the next chapter does belong to humanity, not to them. But the only way they can get control of that is by bluffing. Call the bluff. Yep. It will fail.
That's good stuff. Yeah.
And so that's, that's what it's all about. Knowledge Mountain, that I formed with Jennifer, Knowledge Mountain Church of Perpetual Genesis, non-denominational. Whatever your core faith is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We're just a fill-in-the-gaps kind of a group. But again, we're doing it as a church because this is where we feel that we can work with other churches, and we believe that churches in general are going to be the bodies that are going to be most capable of forming survival communities that can endure and last, because they're going to be based in faith. They're going to be based in a love of Creator. Not going to be a bunch of wackos sitting there with MREs arguing about who's going to be the boss this week.
Oh, man.
All right.
You have thought this through. I know you have.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the final analysis, if just enough people call the bluff, enough people say no. And keep in mind, that's not going to be easy, because with the elites always comes the carrot, then comes the stick. Mm-hmm. So you're not saying no to the carrot. You're saying no to the stick. But if enough people are willing to say no to the stick, then what they have will unravel. Keep in mind that during the American Revolution, only 70% of the colonists participated and stood up and took the risk to be part of the revolution.
I didn't know the percentage was that high.
On the sidelines or helped the British.
I didn't know the percentage was that high. Did you say 7 or 70?
70% just set aside. 30% were involved in the revolution.
Yeah.
And 70% were just, sitting on the sidelines or working with the British. So in the case of our own revolution, it only took 30% of the population to form a sufficient critical mass to free the country. And I think that's, you know, a good measure. So, yeah, I mean, we just have to focus on, you know, getting enough of a critical mass of people who are going to make that difference. That's where it's at.
I think we're gathering more of them every day, and I would submit to you and to the world that there, I think there are more people interested in perhaps giving their lives in the cause of freedom than those who are willing to lose their lives in furtherance of enslavement.
Yeah,
maybe they ought to think that over.
I think that's the case. You know, I think people do. We will sacrifice for our fellow men. You know, we often hear the stories about a soldier who throws himself on a grenade to save his friends. All right. We're programmed to do this. It's within us. We're capable of doing it. You know, the key to us prevailing, and here I have to speak as a guy who was a born-hard geek for the vast majority of his life. You know, I was a Spock wannabe. Logic is tweeting bird. I didn't want to have that. And still the same. What's going to make the difference is walking humbly with your God.
Yeah.
That's what's going to make the difference.
Yep. If he sees fit to rewrite your DNA and make you radiation proof, trust me, that'll happen. I'm saying if.
You know, you got to have, for me, it's really a case of no longer worrying about, oh my God, do I have enough of this? Do I have enough of that? Do I have enough of the other thing? Because bottom line, we're looking at something that's going to last for so many years. I don't care how much you stockpile, it's not going to last. And at some point, you're going to have to be self-reliant. So you really, instead of this mentality of I'm going to have full preparedness for the full duration or whatever, no, all you're doing is creating a buffer. That's it.
Yeah.
All you're creating is a buffer so you can get to creating better renewable solutions. But it's pulling together with people and having faith in Creator, believing in our own nobility, in our inventiveness, in our initiative, in our ability to have insight into things and change. And so I go, you know, on a basis of kind of like, for me, I guess the best way to say it is I see my life in a long, dark tunnel with many twists and turns. And it's pitch black. I know at the end of the tunnel, there's blue sky and beautiful light. And getting there is a long trip with twists and turns. And when you walk with Creator, what happens is Creator lights a candle in the darkness. You walk to that candle. And then you wait. And sure enough, Creator will light another candle. You walk to that candle. And then so on and so on and so on. And you walk from candle to candle. That's faith. And so that's, you know, how I have changed in my view of all of this. And there are a lot of people out there, John, who have been in awareness. They tend to be 45 to 65 years of age as a rule. There's a lot more younger ones coming in now. And I'd say at least 80% of the time when I'm asking them, they're telling me that they've been in awareness since they were children. And they've had lives to prepare for what is coming. These people are really treated badly. They're mocked and humiliated by friends and families and spouses. You know, it's, I don't want to hear about it. It's nonsense. Shut up. They get ostracized. You know, fastest way to fall off a Christmas card list is talk about Planet X.
Right.
And, you know, you get the feeling, boy, now I know how Noah felt. All right. And the biggest frustration for these folks, because they endure it, all of the abuse, is they go, I have all this knowledge, I have all this awareness, but I don't have the wherewithal to go buy beans, bullets, and bunkers. And they're frustrated. And what I try and tell them is, well, Creator didn't give you the awareness so that you would go out and buy beans, bullets, and bunkers. Your mission as someone in awareness is to be a teacher, a mentor, someone to bring a hopeful message. Because the folks that are going to be surviving are going to be coming to awareness right up against the wall. What you've had the benefit of years and in many cases decades to assimilate for these people is going to become something immensely difficult, immensely trying. And it's going to be hard for them to keep their moral compass, to maintain their nobility as humans, and to go at this with an enlightened view of creating a better future for humanity. This is where your lifetime of preparation and awareness is your advantage. This is what you bring. This is, you've had the chance to process all of this. And so you're going to be able to help those who are processing. And that's really what the mission of these folks are. And so there's a much broader picture that I see going on. And it's, on one hand, has its horrific elements, and on the other, very noble, very inspiring elements. It's a vast panorama of a turning point in the history of our species.
Yeah, you made a couple of references to Star Trek, but maybe a reference to Star Wars wouldn't be bad. We must all become that Obi-Wan Kenobi character.
There you go.
A little bit of Obi-Wan and everybody. I think that'd make for a pretty good outcome. I got to tell you, Mr. Masters, you know who Pat McGoohan is? Patrick McGoohan. Remember he did the Prisoner series back in the 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember that? Well, we do a little thing sometimes, not often, but sometimes. But it goes something like this. You, Marshall Masters, in the manner of McGoohan, truly have gloriously illustrated and vindicated the right of the individual to be individual. And I hereby induct you into the Order of the Ark Knights, and henceforth we address you as Sir Marshall, and this assembly rises to you, sir. That's it.
Thank you.
Short and sweet, hey. It means a lot to us that we have the benefit of your lifetime of searching and coming up with some answers that a man of conscience, a woman of conscience can live with. And I perceive that you give all of the credit, sometimes known as glory, to your Creator, sometimes known as God Almighty.
I work for Big G.
Me too. Well, may He bless you. May He continue to bless you. And may you return soon and in safety back to Caravan to Midnight at some near point in future.
Look forward to it, John.
So do I. Thanks, Marshall.
Thank you, sir.
Marshall Masters, everybody. Now, look here now. That the Yowza is the your Own World, USA. Y-O-W-U-S-A. Notice I did not say W. It's a W. No, it's a W. Y-O-W-U-S-A.com and KnowledgeMountain.org. All right. Well, it's coming, isn't it? But it'll be exciting. It'll be invigorating. It'll be challenging. I can't think of anything that will make one feel more alive. Well, there's a couple of things. One of them is a close brush with death. That'll do it. And a deep contemplation of eternity. We're all writing our histories right now. Let's write them as closely to, as we can, to the way we wish them to be written. Start now, because today is already yesterday. Until we meet again, hopefully sooner than later, exercise caution in your daily affairs, eyes up always, make ready for what's to come. God bless. Be seeing you.